Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last month, the National Center for Homeless Education released a report revealing there were over 1.5 million homeless students in the United States in 2018, and that is a 15% increase from 2015, and those numbers are expected to continue to grow. We usually think of homelessness as a problem involving adults. Clearly, that isn't true, and that means living in those homeless camps that dot Charlotte and the nation, there are children mixed in with homeless adults. It's a problem that has a particular impact on African American, Hispanic, and LGBTQ young people. Hispanic children had a 33% higher risk of homelessness. Black youth had an 83% higher risk. And LGBTQ young people's chances of being homeless were 120% higher. In a city and a nation as prosperous as any in the history of the world, the reality of homelessness stands in stark contrast to our notions of prosperity. A few years ago, Housing First Charlotte-Mecklenburg planned to end chronic homelessness entirely by 2016. Well, those plans didn't pan out. So what is being done today, particularly for young people who have no place to go? We find out. We're joined by Trish Hobson, the executive director of The Relative. That's a system of resources set up to help children and young people to find shelter and support. Welcome to the program. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Harold Rice, Jr. is Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Community Link. That's a Charlotte organization helping individuals obtain and sustain housing. Thank you for joining us. Oops, wrong microphone. Now you can say thank you.
Thank you.
There we go. And Malcolm Graham is with us. He's District 2 Representative on Charlotte City Council and the Chair of the
Great Neighborhoods Committee.
The Great Neighborhoods Committee.
Yes.
From the great state of Mecklenburg.
That gets us in trouble.
All right. So, does anybody have figures on the number of homeless children that we have in Charlotte now?
Well, according to Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, we have over 4,500. But I think what's interesting about measuring that number is there are often a lot of youth that aren't counted because they sort of hide. I mean, the only way the schools know is if the child or parent reports it. And so what we know from national studies is 1 in 10 13 to 17-year-olds will experience homelessness in a year. And that doesn't matter if you're in a suburban area like Charlotte or out in the country. That's true across the nation. So if you think of 10% of our 13 to 17-year-olds in Charlotte, way more than 4,500.
And actually, 4,500 is a higher number than I had yesterday. I read that it was 4,000. On the other hand, it said that makes about 3% of the student population of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. And I don't know that's correct, but it's pretty close. Among homeless children and teens, Trish, would we be counting those helped by the relatives, people who are being helped by social services, et cetera?
Sure, of course. So the relative serves 7 to 24-year-olds. So under the federal definition of homelessness, youth count up to the age of 24, so just so you get a perspective of what we're talking about. But at our shelter, where we actually let 7 to 17-year-olds stay for a short period of time, we serve about 350 a year. Not all of those are homeless. Some of them are runaway, but the majority are homeless. And they are going to school. We make sure they get to school every day and work with their parents or guardians or Department of Social Services to do what we can to get them to their next safe place.
And we'll talk more about what you do and how you do it, but do they come to you voluntarily?
Yes, yes.
They walk up to the door and say,
I need
help.
Often, yeah, or sometimes their parents will bring them in. We have, when the parents are homeless, sometimes, like, the mom might be sleeping in a car, but she'll say, I need a safer place for my kid, and so she'll walk them up. So it's not always the kid walking up, but yes, they come in voluntarily. The schools, our guidance counselors at Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools are very aware of what we do, and they refer kids over to us and families over to us. Work closely with organizations like Community Link, Salvation Army, who are also serving families who are homeless. So yeah, they come to us from lots of different directions, but it's totally voluntary.
Okay. Harold, how many homeless children are in that situation because their parents are too, as opposed to being asked to leave? Because I mentioned LGBTQ people, and quite often those young people are asked to leave or told to leave by their parents. Or how many are homeless because they chose to leave because of a dangerous situation at home?
Yeah, I'm not sure of that number, but I know we serve over 500 children in Mecklenburg County. Obviously, we serve the head of household, which is an adult parent, but the 500 children are impacted by homelessness as well. And so we are partnering with a Child's Place on a family child stability program where you have the invisible homeless that are in the hotels, which are not counted towards the homeless count, and they may not resurface at school unless they the school social worker understands that they are homeless. And so we're trying to help resolve that issue there because, again, they had a place to call home, mm-hmm. quote unquote, last night because they stayed in a shelter or a hotel.
So if we know a number of people, because we do this periodic point in time count. That's not counting. It's kind of like it's not quite as accurate as the census one would think. So could we be missing a whole slew of people, adults and children? We are missing a whole bunch of people because we just don't know where they are.
Correct.
They haven't identified.
Correct. And a few years ago, they moved from not counting individuals that are in the hotels. So they're not counting at that point in time count. So we are missing a lot of people.
So your goal at the Relatives, Trish Hobson, is to keep children safe and to put families back together. Mm-hmm. How successful are you at the latter?
Well, we do have at the crisis shelter where we serve the younger, the 7 to 17-year-olds, we have about 80% that are able to go back home. So we feel like that's to a safe and stable environment with their family. So we feel like that's a great number. When we're talking about our older sort of youth, the sort of the 17 to 24-year-olds, it's much more difficult. Most of those kids don't have family support at all. So many, many of our young people have been kicked out of their homes. Their families have abandoned them completely. The LGBTQ issue is a huge reason why a lot of these kids get kicked out. But also we have parents who are, you know, maybe living in a very poor, you know, very poverty situation where they're getting public assistance. And if their child has a felony, they can't have anybody with a felony in their house, so they have to kick them out. Sometimes I am surprised every day. I don't know why I am. I've been doing this for a long time at the number of parents that just say, you're 18, I've done my part, you're done. And just put them on their way. And as you can imagine, if you know an 18-year-old or 17-year-old, been one yourself, trying to do that on your own from going to living in a house to becoming independent is virtually impossible. So that's what we do with our younger adults is we help them sort of manage that process. But, you know, over the half of the kids we see at that resource center, young, I call them kids, 18, 24-year-olds, are homeless, and they're trying to struggle on their own, and they don't want to go to the shelters. They are hiding by doubling up with their friends.
How important is it to put families back together?
It's incredibly important. I mean, people need support. That's the way we're built as human. We need support around us to help us get really anywhere. So if we don't have family support, or at least something that feels like family, if we're out there on our own, it's very difficult to, you know, get a job, live in a house, and manage your own. You know, if your dryer breaks, who do you ask to come fix it? You know, any number of little things on top of really big things like my car broke down and I can't possibly get to work, I have no money for a bus pass, can totally derail you if you don't have some sort of family support.
If a family falls apart as a result of being homeless, because quite often, and we'll talk about this a little in depth a little bit later on, but the services that we have tend to split families up, at least while they're homeless. But when they're split up because of a substance abuse problem or a physical abuse problem or a sexual abuse problem in the home or something else like that, when you put them back together, if you can put them back together, how long does it hold?
Well, I want to be clear that when we're talking about putting the family back together, it's always if it's a safe and stable environment for the child. So if it's not, if it's an abusive situation or any of those things you just mentioned, that's when we bring in the Department of Social Services.
Sometimes kids leave because they're like oil and water with their parents. It's not because the parents are abusing them. Perhaps the parents have a different point of view on how strict to be, and the kid rebels against that.
Yes.
So when you try to put those back together, how long does that hold? Because it's hard to change those kinds of behaviors.
So we don't have long-term outcomes on that, but we do a lot of family counseling. So we work closely with those families to see if there's a way to reconcile so that they can live safely together. We do check on that child for a year out. We call every 3 months to say, are you still feeling safe? Do you need any resources? That type of thing. So But I don't have any longer-term outcomes than that.
You've heard all this before, Malcolm, because you're nodding to almost everything that's being said, and you've been both on City Council and in the State Senate for a long time, and because you were on council before you were at the Senate, now you're back. Does this seem like a solvable problem that government can play a major role in actually solving?
I think we have a role to play for sure. Certainly, Mecklenburg County takes the lead on homelessness in the community. Obviously, the city of Charlotte has a role to play, a significant role to play, because the homeless population is growing rapidly. It's a very visible thing now in uptown Charlotte, yep. Not only at night, but during the day. And so there are a number of supported services programs that the city has to work with organizations and agencies throughout the community. For an example, our 211 coordinated entry system, which is available every day of the week, working with United Way to return people experience homelessness to stable housing. We have our Way Home Endowment, which is rent subsidies to households who would otherwise be homeless, with a preference to veterans who find themselves in that particular situation, as well as federal funding that we receive that we then earmark to local organizations like Community Link. That's really working to solve the problem in our community.
Is that on top of what the county does? Because the county is in charge of social services.
Yeah, it's in addition to what the county is doing. And here's the rub for me, Mike. City, county, we work collaboratively together. I think we're working in a manner that's effective and efficient. But I wish there was a way on a number of issues, including this issue, that we can be as one. We talked about this issue before consolidation. We're both trying to solve the same problem. We're both working in the same zip code. Sometimes we're not on the same page, but certainly if we can coordinate our efforts, and we're trying as hard as we can to do that, we can be a lot more effective and efficient in terms of solving the problems.
Are you tripping over each other?
I don't think it's a matter of tripping over each other. It's a matter of making sure that the left hand knowing what the right hand is doing. Mm-hmm. For an example, the county, as you indicated, is taking the lead on a number of issues. My passion as the chairman of the neighborhood committee is to work on 30% and under AMI. I had a great conversation with Liz Chandler earlier this week about the women's shelter as well as the men's shelter, and getting people from under bridges into shelters. That should be a priority, not for the county, but also a priority for the city, and providing funding for them to do so.
AMI is average median income, correct?
Yes. Okay. Area median income.
Mm-hmm. Harold, we know that we have this problem with affordable housing. We've talked about it ad nauseum on this program, and it's in every newscast and in the newspaper almost every day, and the city has made it a spearhead issue for them. But you report that 40% of our workforce cannot afford safe and decent housing. 40%. That's an enormous number. Where does that come from?
And it's probably higher than that, you know. We're seeing rents are $1,200 on average. And the service sector is the individuals that we are trying to place in housing. And to Malcolm's point, the 30% or below, you had enormous amount of turnout for the mezzanine just a couple of weeks ago at Freedom Drive from the Charlotte Housing Partnership. And the large portion of those individuals are fighting or trying to apply for those 30% and below units. Mm-hmm. And that's just to let you know the problem is that, you know, the wages aren't paying for the housing that we have currently today.
We'll talk more about that and the housing problem and youth housing, homelessness, I should say, of young people. Harold Rice Jr. is with us from Community Link, Trish Hobson from the Relics, and Malcolm Graham from City Council at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the problem of homelessness with a focus on homeless children in Charlotte with Trish Hobson, who is the executive director of The Relatives. That's an organization that helps children who are in need of housing. Harold Rice Jr. is Vice President, COO of Community Link. They do similar work helping individuals obtain and sustain housing. And Malcolm Graham is with us from City Council District 2. In 2017, Charlotte had a known homeless population, adults and children, of 1,476 people. A year later, the number rose to 1,668, and in 2019, there were 2,106. The 2020 point in time count, which is where they go out and they talk, they seek out homeless people where they may be living and count them, took place, I think, in the last 3 months.
End of January.
Okay, so when will those numbers be released?
We usually don't get them until the summer, honestly. There's a lot of massaging that goes on with the
why? What does that mean, massaging?
Well, that's a great question. Harold and I both sit on a committee that of the continuum of care that works closely with the people that are doing the pit count. I think it just takes a long time to download the surveys. They use an app, and they're trying to massage a lot of different data. It's not just who's homeless, but what is your income? Where have you been staying? How long have you been homeless? And so they ask a lot of questions, and so I think they're just trying to get all that data together. They have to report it to the government by, like, June 30th,
correct,
I think.
By June 30th.
So do we expect, Harold, these numbers to rise again this year?
I would, yes, obviously.
Substantially?
Well, we've seen street homelessness increase. Encampments increase, and so we would definitely expect the numbers to increase.
Aside from the morality of this, Malcolm, of having so many homeless people in such a prosperous area, and it's not just Charlotte, it's happening all over the country, but what does that say about us as a city? What does it say about us as a nation that we can't seem to get a handle on this? I don't recall as a young person, a teenager, seeing any homeless people anywhere. That was something that you associated with the Great Depression.
We got a lot of work to do, and as I said earlier in the show, it's a very visible problem before it was a nighttime problem. You saw folks homeless at night, and now during the day in Uptown Charlotte, in which I represent in my district, it's very visible. And so we have a moral obligation as a community, city, county, nonprofit organizations, those in our giving community, to kind of work together to combat the problem. Certainly, it's not unique to Charlotte. Every major city in this country has a significant homeless problem. So not only do we need legislation locally, again, service providers working together, but it has to be a national strategy as well.
The relatives deals directly with children, young people. What's the beginning age, starting age?
7 to 24.
7 to 24. And as you say, a lot of these kids are released at 18 to fend for themselves. And I couldn't have done it. So why should they be able to do it? What does that do to a child? Whether they're homeless because daddy lost his job and then therefore they lost the house, or because there's some other problem going on in the house and they're trying to fend for themselves, they may or may not be in school. What does that do to a child?
Well, I mean, it's hugely traumatic. As you can imagine, even if you're in a very intact family with, a safe, stable, loving family, it's still a very traumatic event to be homeless. There's studies that are done about, kids that spend time in a shelter as a kid, they are enormously more likely to be homeless themselves as adults. And it creates a sense of trauma about them not feeling stable and connected to people. But most of our kids, honestly, are coming from traumatic backgrounds already. They're not coming from sort of the intact, stable, loving family. So this just adds to the trauma, And I think one of the things we have to address is that we have to be able to address the people's trauma who are going through the homelessness, because yes, we need to get them into housing, and that is first and foremost, and that's always we say, get them into housing, and then we'll wrap the services around them, and I think everybody in this room can agree with that. But if you're not addressing the mental health issues that come from living on the streets, for having to be in survival mode every day, wondering where am I going to eat, where am I going to wash my clothes, where am I going to go to the bathroom, I mean, that is a level of trauma and stress that luckily, I can't understand on a daily basis. I can just empathize.
And Trish brings up a great point. About a decade ago, we had a project working with aging out of foster care youth. As soon as they turned 18, it was a pilot where we put them in apartments. And they had so much trauma where they couldn't continue on with understanding that this was their unit, their dwelling. They didn't have the cognitive ability to understand that this is their start of their new life. And so the trauma part was really important back then.
The National Center for Homeless Education has a publication called Hidden in Plain Sight, Homeless Students in America's Public Schools, indicating that a lot of times we don't know that these kids are homeless because they just look like kids. Is that a plus or a minus?
And I would say I think people know, especially practitioners, the social workers, the teachers. You'll know by if the children are wearing the same clothes every day, or if other children are saying that they have a certain smell or things of that nature. You can also tell by the free and reduced lunch, perhaps. So I think there are signs, is whether we're paying attention to it or not.
Evidently, there are 28,000. Somewhere around, these numbers are never exact, 28,873 homeless children enrolled in North Carolina public schools in a given year. That was the 2017-2018 school year. And these numbers were rising in the last previous years leading up to those numbers. Do we know how that compares to other states? Are we an outlier, or are we just like everybody else, Tennessee, South Carolina?
I don't know the number, but I have some friends that work in South Carolina on this particular issue as well, and they said that it's a national issue that kids, families find themselves in this situation of homelessness and living in hotels. Sometimes they're a part of an official count, sometimes they're not. And so it's really kind of hard to gauge unless they self-identify themselves as being homeless. But the problem is real. And it goes to demonstrate that our school systems have a lot more to deal with than just reading, writing, and arithmetic. They're dealing with a whole lot of social and family health issues, mental issues, et cetera. So it's a tough environment for kids growing up in 2020.
So again, the National Center for Homeless Education reports that the vast majority, and you can correct these figures if you think they're wrong, the vast majority of homeless children in schools are living with another family. About 73% of them are living with another family. About 15% are living in hotels and motels, as you just mentioned. 8.5% are in shelters or awaiting foster care. 3.8% are living in abandoned buildings or campgrounds or parks or cars. Of the children living with another family, is their whole family living with another family, or have they been placed with another family? Because the number is 73%.
Generally, their family is doubling up with another family. So that goes that. So there's sort of this cycle, I guess you might call it, of homelessness, and that's sort of the first stage. Like, well, we're going to go stay with Aunt Sue for a while until Aunt Sue gets tired of us, and then they might get kicked out, and then they might have to separate, or then they might have to go to a shelter. And it just sort of is this declining set of resources until they actually end up meeting the HUD definition of homelessness, which is they're living on the street or in a shelter. Often. That 73%, the family may be intact and just living on somebody's couch.
Basically. How many of these kids fall through the cracks and never get help from the city or other non-governmental organizations like yours?
Well, of course, it's really hard to judge who's not getting reported. But I will say in the Leading on Opportunity Task Force report, they reported there were 45,000 what we call disconnected youth. And the definition of that is a youth that is not going to school and not working. So you got to think, that's 45,000 18 to 24-year-olds who almost have to be homeless, right? If you're not working and you're not going to school, unless you're just independently wealthy, you know, you're not going to be able to sustain that. So that's the number I put out there a lot, is 45,000 18 to 24-year-olds potentially homeless or very close to it.
And of the people that you help and that you help, Harold, what's the length of time, the average length of time that people are struggling to find housing?
So our goal is to, when we connect with an individual, to find housing within 45 days or less. Obviously, that's tough given this market. And so we're probably at 60 days finding a unit. And so that means they have to continue staying in their shelter or their car or the encampment until we can place them in housing. But again, our conversation is about the stability and the long-term stability of that unit. Can this person afford the current rent structure the way it is? At $1,200 on average, long-term, at a service sector wage.
So we have young people who are homeless because their parents are homeless, sometimes they've been separated from their parents as a result of that. We have situations where young people are asked to leave a home by their parents or told to leave. Sometimes the child decides to leave because the situation there to them is intolerable, which is the larger group. The people who are homeless because their parents are, or young people who are homeless because they had no choice, they had to leave.
Well, again, I would break it up into the different age groups. So for our 7 to 17-year-olds who still legally have to have a guardian, right. Usually it's the family. That's what we see. But for our 18 to 24-year-olds, we're seeing that the family has basically abandoned them in one way. That's the majority of what we see for our population that we're serving.
And there are a number of families in our community today simply cannot keep up with the rising cost of apartments. They are working. They're the working homeless. Right. So they have to live in hotels. They're at the mercy to a cash pay hotel or a nice hotel. But, you know, it takes all of their money. And so they can't afford the security deposit, the first month rent to get into an apartment. And even if they did, they can't afford to monthly rent of $1,200 a month when they're only making $8 or $10 an hour.
But, you know, we've had periods in this country where inflation was rampant. And we're not in an inflationary period right now. It haven't been for years. What's going on? What is different about the world in America and in North Carolina and in Charlotte today than 40 years ago? What's different?
I think 40 years ago, there was a lot of caring for one another. Each one must reach one and teach one, and government was a part of the solution in terms of helping people help themselves. I think today in 2020, it's really, if you listen to national leaders, everybody's employed. Everybody has a job. Everything is great.
And even if that were true, sometimes these jobs just don't pay enough.
They just don't pay enough, or you don't take into consideration that people may be counted as employed, but they're working two and three jobs to make ends meet. And so I think there's a false analysis about what's happening.
But why?
Because we are now in a scenario where it's have and have nots, and people tend to love the people that have the most and care less about people that are struggling, my perspective.
And I would also add about the income piece, you have individuals that have non-verifiable income. And so they're working as a hairdresser that's not necessarily a hairdresser, but washing hair at a salon, and they're not getting a paycheck, but they're working. And so they're giving plasma. They're doing things to have income. But when they are going to present for a unit, they don't have verifiable income, which, again, knocks them out of the game for that.
Trish, you say that young people, youth homelessness is often different from adult homelessness because kids don't generally go to shelters. They crash on couches belonging to friends and family. How long can they stay in that tenuous situation? And if they don't go home after a period, what happens to them?
So they can basically make that happen until they run out of friends. I mean, and it's sort of one of those things where you just start to burn bridge after bridge, or people get tired. Okay, you've been here 3 months. You know, I can't afford to keep you here anymore. And so, you know, they can keep that going for years, really, which makes it really difficult because then they don't meet the HUD definition of homelessness, so they don't qualify for a lot of the subsidies that Harold's talking about. Also, they don't end up in our PIT count, the point in time count, because we're only counting people who are really homeless. So it really skews the numbers, which is problem number one. And then problem number two is many of them do have sort of the mental health issues I was talking about, where a permanent supportive housing situation would be the best fit for them. But again, they don't qualify as like chronically homeless under the definition. I know I'm throwing a lot of terminology at you, but that's sort of the world we work in. They don't qualify as chronically homeless because they don't meet the definition of homelessness under HUD. And, you know, it's just very complicated. So we've been very, very fortunate to find some outside funders who sort of understand that and are willing to help us get these kids into housing without having to meet all these crazy definitions. But this is where, at a national level, I'm looking at Malcolm here because he's the only one that has the the route to the national level, we really need to change that definition of homelessness for young people because it's just such a different experience for them. And that is, if you've ever looked at the Chapin Hall study on youth homelessness, that's one of their main recommendations as well, is to change that definition so that we can get more youth, more young people, the resources they need, and change that trajectory so they don't end up.
And couch surfing and being doubled up used to be a definition under HUD, and they changed it. Yeah, so they need to go back to that. Good point.
When kids do end up alone and on the street, homeless, statistics are really bleak. They tell us that 1 in 3 will be lured into prostitution within 48 hours.
The victimization is horrible. It's a very scary thing. We had a client recently who was always been so docile, just easy to get along with. She came in and literally blew up over anything, pulled out a knife, you know, and we were like, what is going on? And she said, I had to sleep on the streets for the past 2 nights and I'm scared to death and I've had to start carrying a knife because I'm so scared. Wow. And that is just one example of how, yes, I mean, there's victimization in all kinds of different ways, but it's a scary thing to be on the streets alone.
62% of LGBTQ youth report being physically harmed while experiencing homelessness. 47% of non-LGBTQ young people report the same thing. These are national stats. Can we assume that this area, this region, this state would be similar?
Yes.
Wow.
Not to think so.
The push in Charlotte, Malcolm, is now focused on housing stability, preventing people from losing their homes in the first place. But when over half of African-American and Latinx renter households in Mecklenburg are already housing cost burdened, how do you accomplish that? You got all these people who are spending all their money on their homes.
It's difficult, Mike, and I'll tell you it's a hard nut to crack. Obviously, we can't build ourselves out of this. We talked about the units on Freedom Drive, 30% AMI, that only accounted for 19 units.
Right,
and so we got to begin to really invest more in housing. Just on yesterday, the City Council received their applications for the housing trust fund.
You were in the legislature.
Yes.
The city of Charlotte, no city in North Carolina has the ability to mandate a developer do anything. They can't say, okay, you want to put this apartment complex here? Well, 30% of them have to be affordable housing units. We can't do that. You were in the legislature. Why can't we do that? Why won't the legislature do that for particularly urban counties? I got 20 seconds.
Partisan politics. I think there are a number of strategies that we would love to have in our tool chests here in Charlotte that we simply will not get in Raleigh based on the demographics of the legislators.
Malcolm Graham used to be a state senator. He's now back in Charlotte as a city council district representative. He's here with Harold Rice Jr., the vice president and COO of Community Link, and Trish Hobson, executive director of The Relatives. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's on to New Hampshire in the chase for the Democratic presidential nomination, while South Carolina's primary also looms large.
We still have a fight on our hands.
We're in this for the long haul.
Will the first in the South primary be as pivotal as it's been in years past? Join Charlotte Talks for a conversation with experts on Palmetto State politics. We'll be at Winthrop University's DiGiorgio Campus Center on Wednesday, February 12th at 7 p.m. Register now to attend at WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about homeless young people in Charlotte with Trish Hobson from The Relatives, Malcolm Graham from Charlotte City Council District 2, and Harold Rice Jr. With Community Link. Last year, Community Link, Harold, helped 2,246 people, if I have these numbers correct, through your homeless to housing program. 2,246. Who were these people? How did they become homeless?
So that was in 17 counties in North Carolina. So we have services from here all the way to Halifax, North Carolina.
Wow.
So these are individuals who are chronically homeless, who have been living on the street a year or more. These are also individuals who had episodes of homelessness and have visited our coordinated entry process, and so we've placed them in housing here locally. These are individuals that are fleeing domestic violence, and so a whole line of service, veteran homelessness, and so these are all of the above.
And some of them are children, right?
Some of them are children.
How do you find homes for these people when we have such a shortage of affordable housing?
So we have a pool of providers. I use the word providers versus landlord because that's an oppressive word, and we want to make sure that we are coming from a state of empowerment. So we have a pool of providers that understand the affordable housing issue, understand that they want to be a part of the solution, and they keep their rents at an affordable rate as much as they can, and we try to continue to educate them. The good part about it is they know when they're with us, they have supportive services, some people that are wrapping around, as Trish talked about earlier, social workers, master level social workers, housing coordinators that are talking about Tennessee education and what's next in your life to move on to try to maintain this unit.
CMPD has declared our violence program to be a public health crisis. The city council is now taking a public health approach toward the violence problem that we have in Charlotte. Given that homeless children are four times likely to develop respiratory infections, twice as likely to develop infections as those who have stable homes, and when you consider that homelessness disrupts a child's world and their education, which has long-lasting impact throughout their lives as they move from place to place, not to mention the hunger and the danger and the prostitution they might have to engage in order to survive to find their next meal, homelessness in general seems to me to be a public health crisis, isn't it?
Well, you took the words right out of my brain. It is a public health crisis that needs the it's not a law enforcement type of initiative. It's like Harold said, it's really about how do we provide the wraparound services. All these agencies need to be working together collaboratively to address the issue. Certainly Mecklenburg County, which leads the initiative for mental health and wellness, CMPD, to make sure that we're protecting our kids and our children and our community, the school system to ensure that they're getting a quality education, the health department to make sure that they're healthy. So all of these agencies and have to be working collaboratively together to address the issue. It just can't be a one item. I can't, as a council member, say, well, that's a county initiative, so we'll let them take the lead. Yeah. No, I want to work collaboratively with them to see what we can do together in an effective and efficient manner.
There are those in government who would say this is not really a government problem. This is a marketplace problem. And there are those out there doing the work that the relatives do and that the Community Link does, saying that we need the government's help. How do you see the partnership? What's the ratio here?
Not sure of the ratio, but I wanted to talk about the partnership. I think the affordable housing we have is the affordable housing we create, and that's nonprofits. I think we have to continue coming together, getting land, buying property together to keep the units affordable, even if we have to consider some alternative ways of home ownership for individuals that can move through that avenue. But I think we're not leveraging each other enough, and we need to continue to do that because the problem will be here as long as we're here. And so that's one solution, is that nonprofits and organizations can come together and leverage each other to purchase land and purchase units, to purchase property, to keep it affordable.
I mean, you can't force people to pay more money in salary. You can't force people to rent their apartments below market rate or sell their houses below market rate. That's not how this country works. It never has worked this way. So what can you do?
You know, it's really difficult. I do think that the government has a role to take care of the people of our country, right? And if our...
Is that what the provide for the general welfare means in the Constitution?
I think to welfare the people, yeah. And I think we need additional funding from local government as well as the private sector. We need more community partners. We need a focused approach on mental health on this particular population, more supportive housing units. And lastly, for our neighbors to accept those units in some neighborhoods. So it's a collective issue that we have to work together on.
We're going to spend just a couple minutes now speaking with a young woman who is a client, if that's how you refer to them. You're helping her at the relatives. She's 18 years old, homeless, prefers to remain anonymous, and we're going to keep that promise. Thank you for joining us, and we'd like you to share part of your story and experience. Thank you for being here, by the way. You moved to Charlotte, I understand, at the age of 16 to escape an abusive relationship with your father. In what way was he abusive?
Physically abusive. So it started when I was 12. It's just really hard to deal with growing up. So over time, my grandparents suddenly had me stay with them for months at a time. And we traveled a lot. So every now and then, I still had to see my father. But overall, things were better with my grandparents.
And then they moved to Michigan, I believe. Mm-hmm. And you decided not to go with them. Why?
because, well, for one, I got tired of being in the city because the city of Detroit is like, I don't like the atmosphere there. Like sometimes, like my father or grandparents would have me run errands, and at night, I wasn't comfortable with that. I didn't like the winters, and I didn't like the fact that every now and then I still had to see my father, not knowing what he'd do. Like, he was unpredictable.
So when they moved back to Michigan and you decided not to go with them, how old were you then?
I was 18.
18. I was trying to remember yesterday when I knew you were coming on what was going through my head at 18. And I really, it's been so long ago that I could not remember. But you thought you had saved it. Did you believe that you had saved enough money to be able to support yourself in the absence of any adult help?
Yes, for a while.
For a while. You knew that it would only last for a while?
Yes.
How long did it last?
Like 2 months.
Wow. That sounds brave to me. Do you think of yourself as being brave?
Sometimes.
Yeah, I would think it takes great courage to do that, particularly if you knew that at some point the money was going to run out. Did you think that by the time the money ran out, you would have found a place to stay and you would have found a way to support yourself?
Not really. Like, the day it ran out, I knew I had to do something that same day. So I didn't have a complete plan, but as I went through my day, I kind of just improvised.
So when they left and you had some money, where did you stay?
So sometimes I'd stay at some hotels or just pay people to like let me stay at their house for a night or two.
And when the money ran out, what happened?
I left like... when I still stayed with my grandparents, we'd riding around Charlotte, I've seen like the Salvation Army shelter, not knowing what it was at the time, until I asked my grandmother what it was, and she said it was. So I remembered it. So that same day, my money ran out. I caught the bus to get to the shelter and tried to figure out how I could get in.
Did they let you in?
No, because I didn't have ID at the time.
You didn't have identification and they wouldn't let you in?
Right.
So what did you do about that?
Well, at the Hal Marshall building, not too far from it, they referred me to the relatives and they helped me get into another shelter.
When young people like this come to you, Trish, how do you help them? She didn't have identification. She didn't have ID. Why would you help her?
Well, honestly, you'd be surprised at the number of young people that come to us because they just want us to help them get their ID. And so, young people come to us for all kinds of reasons, and we have great intake staff that helps, that's really resourceful in helping to try to understand what is the real problem. So if she comes to us asking us to help with ID, then we're saying, well, why do you need ID? Are you looking for a job? And then she might reveal, I'm not exactly sure how this happened. But that's how we help. We try to understand. And you do have to, you have to meet that immediate need of getting ID because you can't get a job. You can't.
Got a platform.
You can't do anything.
And you're up against a wall, obviously, when you went and you couldn't get into the shelter because you didn't have ID. And somebody told you about the relatives and you went to get that. What is that experience like, to be at the mercy of other people? What is that like?
To me, it's unpredictable because, growing up, I didn't trust people easily because of the way I was raised,
sure,
dealing with my father. So...
So, once again... It takes great courage to put your faith in somebody else, to let them help you. Did you ever spend any time sleeping on the street? Did you ever, were you ever not in some place that was safe?
Not really.
Not really.
Yeah.
Do you consider the shelters safe?
Not all the time.
Because?
Because, the first few nights that I stayed at the other shelter that I was allowed to stay in, without ID,
mm-hmm,
I woke up to someone screaming, threatening to kill everyone just because they were snoring. And they had to call the police and security and everything and to ban her.
Are you staying someplace safe now?
Yes.
You're working with someone, I'm told, who has pointed you in the right direction in terms of getting your GED. How close are you to achieving that?
Very close. I passed the English part of it, and now I'm prepping for the mathematics. So it's working out really well.
Yeah. And you also have a job.
Yes.
it's a first job, right? Mm-hmm. How's that experience been for you?
It feels very good. Like, it'll be my first job. It's another new experience for me and another achievement.
And you're also on a housing waiting list at The Relatives, I'm told. What does that mean, a housing waiting list?
So it's like they put, I don't understand it that well either, but.
Well, Trish will explain it to us.
I was going to say, I can help. So we have a housing program where we place young people into apartments around town, and we provide a subsidy for about a year. But we are limited in our funding for that particular program, so we have to have the funds so that we can pay the subsidy. So some of our funding comes in July. Some of it comes in you know, December. And so depending on the funding is depending on when we have availability to work. So that is the list that she is on.
Everybody's experience with homelessness, I'm sure, is absolutely different. But when you talk to other people, either in the shelter or at The Relatives or just in your day-to-day life who are homeless, is there a thread? Is there a commonality in their story that you recognize in yourself? Oh, that's me, or I went through that, or I understand you as a homeless person because I experienced this myself.
And some people, like, everyone's story is different, mm-hmm. So of course it can't relate to everyone, but I feel kind of good because I know I'm not alone. It's like, haven't gone through that.
I've heard homeless people being interviewed elsewhere, and they say that one of the most difficult things, particularly the homeless that we see on the street, is that people don't make eye contact with them. People don't talk to them because I guess they're afraid of them, or they're afraid they're going to be asked for money or whatever it may be, and they feel that it's dehumanizing. If you just look me in the eye and say good morning, that's almost enough to get them through the day. Have you experienced that?
Not really.
Okay. You're a young person. This is your first experience with this, but you've had a hell of a life. What, from your point of view, is there enough help out there for people in your situation?
I believe there is.
Really? How difficult is it to find? Because I would, if I was homeless, I'm not sure, and I do these shows all the time, I'm not sure where I would go. is it easy to navigate the system, or is it difficult?
Well, I mean, it depends on, like, everyone's circumstances. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, not everyone grows up knowing about the resources that are out here. So, and it's just a matter of how you find out about it,
right,
and where you are when you find out about it.
What do you see as your future? What do you want?
Well, success and, like, financial stability. And I also want to be in a position where I can help others, because there have been times when, like, people would give me stuff and I'd feel bad, because I'm not always in a position to give back.
Yeah. Malcolm, we've set organizations and groups around the city have set goals in the past to try to end homelessness, and we didn't achieve those goals. Are setting these goals at all achievable unless we have some kind of a systemic change in society? Or are we just going to always be talking about this, always be working the way we're working now toward this end? And I have 20 seconds.
I think we have to be very intentional about solving the problem, intentional about providing the funding, intentional about being on the streets, working with individuals, and working with nonprofit organizations.
Malcolm Graham is representative of District 2 on Charlotte City Council. Harold Rice Jr. is the vice president and COO of Community Link. And Trish Hobson is executive director for The Relatives. And we also have a guest, an unnamed guest, who did a wonderful job and demonstrated once again just how brave you are. Thank you for doing it. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.